starts with you and me. It starts with you and me. We all can be heroes if we take the lead to change the bad to good, to live in harmony. It starts with you. About living with each other, 'cause the future will soon be in their hands. Watching us close, they follow our steps. If we do right, I'm sure they'll understand.
Hello and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, May 4th. 2015. This is Deanna Spingola broadcasting from the Chicago suburbs. This radio program does not have any sponsors or commercial breaks, although I do mention my books, which you will find information about at spingola.com. I wrote the Ruling Elite series that encompasses three books. My new book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences, is available at my website or at Amazon. Please visit screeningsandyhook.com for more information about that book. Please also visit SpingolaSpeaks.net, created by a good friend and longtime listener. All the more recent files of my programs are at that site, RBN. That includes the RBN files, American Free Press files, and of course files from this program. My Twitter account is twitter.com/Deanna Spingola. Okay, I'm trying to get my guest on, we're just having some technical difficulties. Skype just recently over the weekend changed their parameters, and so it just they keep changing this. I'm not sure why. It is just very annoying. But anyway, he is going to attempt to call into the program, which I anticipate that he will do momentarily. But anyway, if you have questions during the program, you may call in at 646-787-1915. We will, of course, be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or preferably from the chat room, spingola.chatango.com. My guest today is Professor Warren B. Rutledge. That is Routledge. He is the author of Holocaust High Priest, Elie Wiesel, Night, The Memory Cult, and The Rise of Revisionism, with a foreword by Guillermo Rudolph. A person may receive that book by going through shop.codoh.com, that's CODOH.com, or, of course, from Amazon. I highly recommend that you also visit EllieWieselTattoo.com. This is Carolyn Yeager's website, and she will be conducting an interview with Professor Rutledge on May 11th. She is the author of Auschwitz, the Underground Guided Tour. And for more information about the professor's work, you may visit the CODO site, CODOH.com, and receive a promotion flyer about the book. You may also read the first three chapters and the appendix of the professor's book. Now, Warren B. Rutledge is the pen name of a retired U.S. university professor at I'm trying to multitask here. It is the pen name of a retired U.S. University professor of humanities. He taught for over 40 years and held tenured positions at 3 major United States universities. The professor, another message. I do not have his phone number. Let me just type it. We talked via Skype about a week ago or a couple of days ago. We had a perfect connection, and it worked well. But I was not able to connect with him via Skype. Usually it will allow a person, Skype will allow you to add a person to a conversation, and it's just not doing that today. Have no idea why it isn't, but it isn't, and so I am texting him via Skype, and I've given him the phone number to call into the program. I've also asked for his telephone number so that I might use the Blog Talk option to call him, but he has tried repeatedly to call me via Skype using the regular Skype ID number, and we're just not able to connect. Okay, I just got his phone number. Okay, I will do that. Yes. I will call you now. Okay, I've got his phone number. Oh, yep. Okay, all righty. Dialing his number. Dialing. Oh, here we go. We are dialing. Oh, jeez. Oh, these technicalities and these things, yes.
Hi, Dina.
Hi. Oh, it's wonderful to talk to you. I am so sorry for these technicalities that are associated with Skype. It's just thank you for calling into the program, Professor.
I could try again to see if we can communicate on Skype because I've got a severe hearing impairment. I can't hear too well on regular telephones, but I hear just fine on Skype.
I understand that. And we were able to communicate very, very well via Skype when we did the trial a few days ago. But Skype, unfortunately, is not allowing me to add you to the conversation. And so I either have to call you or you have to use Skype. You can use Skype and call into the program via your Skype. You can have your headset on, and if you call into, if you call into the program using your Skype, in other words, in your Skype window up at the top, you will see where it says call, and you can call a telephone number.
Okay, when it says call, I click on call, and then the first selection is also call. And then it says Skype call.
Yeah, okay. And then put the number 646-787-1915. Now, and you can
I've done that a couple. Your picture comes up. I dial that number, your picture comes up, and it has a little, it says busy.
Yes, I'm busy. If I answer your phone call in Skype, I will be cut off from Blog Talk. So the only way that we are going to be able to connect you to the program is if you use your Skype. Don't show my picture. Just go up to the put your select contacts, okay? Then go up and say call. And then you're going to select call a telephone number. But don't, you know, just put your select contact so that I am not the contact that you're trying to connect to. Because you're just going to make a telephone call using your Skype program. And you can make calls to people using your program so that you can still continue using your headset. So, do you want to try that?
Oh, I just don't know. I'm so confused about what's happening here. I just clicked on contacts and you came up, and here again it says I'm on the phone. Please call when I get off the phone. And,
right, because I cannot disconnect from Skype. That will end the program. So if you just click on contacts, and then you just go up to call. I know this is very frustrating for you. It must be
I'm going to click on call again. I click on call, and it says Skype call. And so I punch in the number.
Well, you don't want to do a Skype call. You do not want to do a Skype call. You want to just call a telephone number, okay? And that telephone number that you wish to call is 646-787-1915. Because if you continue to you put a one in front of it, but if you continue to call me, via my Skype ID, you're going to get the message, Deanna is on another call. Please try to call again later. You're not going to be able to connect to the... There's only two ways for you to connect to the program. Either via your... as we are doing right now, or if you use your Skype program and make a telephone call to 646-787-1915. I know this is incredibly frustrating. Technology is a wonderful thing, but it's not so wonderful when it doesn't work as you would like to have it work. So
I apologize for this. I'm just so confused. Maybe I should have called you before you went on the program.
I did send you a message 15 minutes before. There's only two ways of doing it. Continue doing the program as we are doing now, or turn up your volume on your telephone. And people are listening. People on the radio are listening. This isn't a private conversation. We are on the radio as we speak. Okay, so that those are the choices: to make a Skype phone call, and don't show my picture, but simply press contacts up, and you're going to remove me from the, you know, don't call me, make a telephone call, okay.
Up
at the top, up at the top where it says call, the first option is call. What you want to do is go down to where it says call phones.
Okay.
Go down to where it says call phones, and then put in that.
It's United States.
Yes, and then call in at 646. 787-1915.
Can I push a 1 first?
There should be an automatic 1 right at the beginning.
Okay.
And then
I'm going to push the number.
Programs, and then you can call in using your Skype and your headphones. Okay?
Okay.
Okay. Bless you. Thank you. I'm so sorry.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay. As you can see, we are having some difficulties here, but let me give you some more information about our guest. Now, the Holocaust High Priest weaves together five compelling and interrelated narratives. The book's main concern is to present the world's first unauthorized biography of Elie Wiesel, and that's how I was taught to pronounce it when I went to a conference where he spoke. It was not a big conference. It was just a gathering where he probably got $25,000 for being there. The first unauthorized biography of Elie Wiesel that shines the light of truth on this mythomaniac who has transformed the word Holocaust into the brand name of the world's greatest hoax. Here, both Wiesel's personal deceits and the whole myth of the 6 million are laid bare for the reader's perusal. It shows how Zionist control of the U.S. government, as well as the nation's media and academic apparatus, has allowed Wiesel and his fellow extremists to force a string of U.S. presidents to genuflect before this imposter as symbolic acts of subordination to world Jewry, simultaneously forcing school children to submit to Holocaust brainwashing by their teachers. The second strand involves close readings of several of Wiesel's published texts, with emphasis on his alleged autobiography, the novel Night, which I happen to have a copy of. I have his trilogy. It was, in fact, it is actually autographed. It's like new. But I purchased it when I attended that conference back in 88, 89, and it has the publishing date of where is the publishing date here? It was just prior to that. I'm not sure. Let's see. 1972 and 1985. This is probably the 1985 edition. And let me just check and see if the professor has. He still is apparently having trouble. Hopefully he will be able to call into the program. The second strand involves close readings of several of Wiesel's published texts, with emphasis on his alleged autobiography, the novel Night. The author demonstrates Wiesel's appalling ignorance of both the physical details and layouts of the Auschwitz and Buchenwald camps. And this ignorance also extends to German administrative protocols and procedures. Amazingly, the novel's chronology of the events said to have really happened in the author's life is also disjointed, confusing, and internally contradictory. The author also shows the role played by the meme of retroactive continuity in the telling of the Holocaust story. Okay, I am still waiting for him to call into the program. I am just so sorry about this. We just thought we had everything let me just type him again. Bless his heart. This must be so frustrating for him. Let's see, 646-787-1915. And bless his heart. I'm just so sorry he's having these difficulties. The third strand involves a an historical account of the rise of Holocaust revisionism, mainly in the U.S. and France, in response to the many obvious lies contained in the Jewish Holocaust narrative. From the sudden appearance of the revisionist work of Professors Butz, B-U-T-Z, and Forison in the 1970s, through the Zundel trials, let's see. I'm communicating with the professor, and 915. You need to select call phones, not my name. Okay. All righty. I may have to read some of the book to you. Anyway, okay. Where was I here? I'm typing and The third strand involves an historical account of the third rise of Holocaust revisionism, and mainly in the U.S. and France, in response to the many obvious lies contained in the Jewish Holocaust narrative. From the sudden appearance of the revisionist work of Professors Butz, B-U-T-Z, and Professor Forison in the 1970s, through the Zundel trials of the 1980s, to the work of contemporary revisionists like Bradley R. Smith, Germar Rudolph, Carlo Montano, Thomas Kuhs, and others today. This study shows, through the words of the Holocaustian extremists themselves, how effective the revisionists have been in demolishing their lies. The fourth strand shows how certain ambitious and unscrupulous U.S. Catholic intellectuals have hitched a ride on the Holocaust bandwagon as a means of advancing. Oh dear. He says they're telling me I need to buy a subscription, and that is just not true. So I will have to call you at your home phone number. Will that be okay? Oh, goodness. What an awful thing. You know, when you think you have everything all worked out, sometimes with technology and with technology. Yeah, you either love your computer or you hate it, okay? I can only call him and hopefully he will be able. No, that is not my. Okay. The only way that we are going to be able to connect to this program, to have the professor connect to this program, is okay. I will call you. I cannot do a Skype call. That is a big problem. I cannot do a Skype call, or I will lose my. I'm so sorry, folks. I am really very sorry for this. Okay. Gosh, Carolyn, I hope you're listening so that you, by the time you have Dr. Rutledge on your program, you can get this figured out, because this is very frustrating. Very frustrating indeed. So, anyway, I'm going to try him again at the 404, at his telephone number, and see if I can. I'm dialing him. I don't know what else to do. I just don't know what else to do, unless I have guests call in to talk about, have callers call in to talk about the Holocaust in general, or
hi, Dina.
Yes. Okay, this is really, unless you can call into the program at the 646 number that I gave you, we will not be able to connect via Skype. I can only connect you to the program if you call in with the 646 number, or if I call you with your telephone number. So is there any way that you can do the program on your phone? We are on the air right now.
I'm on my regular home phone. I'm on speakerphone right now.
Okay.
And I can hear you. If you speak slowly, I can hear you on my speakerphone.
Okay. Let me get a drink of water, and I will stop talking so fast. First of all, you have written a brilliant book. I, since getting the book at Amazon, I literally have not been able to put it down. The people in the scout in the chat room say that you sound wonderful. So I think if you can hear me okay, I think we're good to go.
Well, let's try it. Let's see what happens.
Okay. Bless your heart. I'm so sorry for this frustration. I know that it's very difficult, but anyway, your book is brilliant. Okay? Everyone who is listening to this program needs to purchase this book today. Seriously, today. You can get it on Kindle, via Amazon, which is the way that I purchased it. I have been reading it since I downloaded it. I am just about done. Literally, I wake up in the morning. It's the first thing I have done is open my iPad to read this book. I cannot tell you how many notes and marks. I literally have a note or a highlight on every page. You have put together this book in such an incredible way, and you have shown how the Catholic Church has been totally marginalized by people by infiltrators within the church who have worked with the Holocaust industry to create a Holocaustianity that has literally become the nation's state-sponsored religion. And
you know,
you've shown the demise. Go ahead.
Whoever would have believed when Pope Pius XII died in 1958 that within 30 or 40 years, bishops of Rome, popes of the Catholic Church, would be going to former German camps and bowing down to the God of the 6 million. Whoever would have believed that that would happen when he passed away in 1958? But it has happened. And that's why I dedicate the book to him, because there are quite a few so-called defenders of Pius XII in the United States, and they do a very commendable job within limits of trying to defend Pius XII, but they never question the accusations that are made against him. All they do is base their defense of Pius XII on his rescuing of Jews during World War II. Any defense attorney, the first thing that a good defense attorney would do in a court of law would be to question the credibility of the witnesses, to question the credibility of the accusers, trash them as much as he possibly could in the eyes of the jury. But the people who've been in charge of the Catholic Church in their dialogue, quote-unquote, over the last 50 years with their Jewish interlocutors, they have not done anything of the sort. They just allow themselves to be insulted, and they never respond.
Well, this is just, it's an amazing book. It's an amazing book.
Let's start with Wenzel. I start at the beginning, and I point out how he always likes to say, Pope Pius XII never did enough. He never did enough. Well, what is his definition of enough? He, nor do any of his other accusers, ever say what enough would be. They never describe that. There's a rabbi who teaches at Ave Maria University down in Naples, Florida. And he pays lip service to the Holocaust story, but he says that the Jewish rabbis and the leaders of the major Jewish organizations who launched this campaign against Pius XII, he says this has never been about Pius XII at all. It's never been about him. They know he did everything he could. The whole thing is about changing the Catholic Church and getting the Catholic Church to revise its teachings that it had held to for 2,000 years, and they have been enormously successful in doing that.
Well, I remember reading What Hitler's Pope, and then I also read, oh gosh, this other book that I read, The Hidden Encyclical of Pius the 11th, and just all kinds of books, and never thought about what this meant or how to interpret this. Your book, now I'm not Catholic, but your book is the best explanation of how this all came about that I have ever seen. And I'm not Catholic, but the way that you explain it, you go through the entire history of Wenzel, and you explain how he was able to manipulate the public, how he was able to manipulate even the people, even fellow Jews who did not buy into the nonsensical story of the Holocaust. He even won them over. It was incredible. I just can't say enough good things about your book. I'm just amazed.
Well, there's
go ahead.
Two big points I make here that no one else has ever made. First of all, Pius XII, during the war, he never believed that there was an extermination program going on. I point out, it's not as if he did what he did thinking that there was an extermination program. He knew that there were rumors circulating day in and day out about who knows what. In any kind of a wartime situation, everybody's starting rumors every day of the week unconsciously. But he finally put light on this in 1953. In 1953, he published a long article, which is the article containing the text of a speech he had given. In that year, an international group of lawyers specializing in penal law met in Rome, and he addressed the group. He made two major statements in that. The first is that he talked about Jewish losses during World War II, and he said that hundreds of thousands of Jews died during the war. By 1953, the extermination story had been in existence since 1945. He did not use the word extermination. He used the word removal of hundreds of thousands of Jews. If there were 12 million Jews living before World War II, the loss of 400,000 is completely in line with the demographic group of any people. There are certainly millions of Americans dying every year, but they're replaced. And revisionists have always said that 200,000 to 400,000 Jews died during the war. That's normal for a worldwide population of 12 million people. So he didn't use the word extermination when he spoke to these international lawyers in 1943. He'd used terms like losses and removal. The second thing he did in this speech is he trashed the Nuremberg trials. He essentially said that the Nuremberg trials had nothing to do with legality. Why? Because the Allies, who were the prosecutors, had committed exactly the same kinds of crimes that the Germans were accused of. Now, this is the chief of state speaking when he said that. After all, the Vatican is his state all to its own. And it is an absolutely dramatic thing for him to have said. The only American who had said that at the time of the Nuremberg trials was Senator Taft of Ohio, who strongly criticized the Nuremberg trials as an ex post facto, laws being made up at the last minute to prosecute somebody for laws that were never in existence during the war years. So Pius XII has always been interpreted. He's always presented as somebody who was aware that there was an extermination going on, but said nothing. That's totally false. He knew that there was a persecution going on. There are lots of persecutions going on. Look at all the Polish Catholics who were caught under communism in Eastern Europe. There are lots of persecutions going on during the war, but there was no extermination. And secondly, he criticized the Nuremberg trials as totally unjust and not rendering a fair verdict to the defeated Germans.
Wow. Yeah, I'm just okay. So about Wiesel.
Let's talk about the subject of the book for a minute, Elie Wiesel. Let's talk about him. I talk about his childhood, the way he grew up, and he grew up in a very, very strict Orthodox household, and he was taught to hate Catholicism. He points out in his own autobiographical writings, I was taught to dislike the doctrine of the Blessed Mother. He was always taught to cross the street and never walk in front of a Catholic church and so forth. So he was a guy who was raised by the rabbis, Orthodox rabbis, with just an incredible sense of hatred, which he has been able to take out in his life as an adult. And if you go to the Holocaust Museum, engraved on the front door of the museum, there's a quote from Elie Wiesel, and it says, "For the living and the dead, we must bear witness." But here's a man who wrote that. He was appointed by President Carter to be the first organizer of the Holocaust Museum. Well, to what can Elie Wiesel bear witness? I point out in my book that the two camps in which he claims to have been imprisoned, there's no record of him ever being admitted to either place. There's no train manifest in existence indicating that he was shipped or transported to these camps. There is no train, there's no entrance, there's no evidence that his father ever entered the camps. The same goes for his mother and his three sisters. Two of those sisters survived, by the way, and lived into their 80s. What happened to these poor people? I don't know. But he has no right to talk about bearing witness when he was actually not a witness to any of these events. What he did or how he spent the war years remains a mystery. We don't know what that mystery consists of. if we had access to the papers of the International Tracing Service, which offers detailed records of about 20 million people who were swept up in the displaced persons nightmare during World War II, if we had access to those records, we would be able pretty easily to find out what happened.
Professor, tell us where those records are and the fact that they will not release any information.
In 2007, those records, up until 2007, those records were held in custody of 7 or 8 European countries, Belgium, France, Germany, and so forth. And they were digitized, and copies were sent to the U.S. Holocaust Museum in 2007. A copy should have been sent to the National Archives. If a copy had been sent to the National Archives, I, as a scholar, would be able to consult them without any problem. But since they're held, and 3/4 of the records of the International Tracing Service concern Gentiles, non-Jewish people. So there's no reason why the Holocaust Museum should have the records from the International Tracing Service. But since they do, they will not show them to anybody unless that person is a certified true believer in the Holocaust. So that's one of the reasons why they created the Holocaust Museum in the first place, was to maintain control over history, to maintain control over records. It is a disgrace that the United States government allowed those records to be given to the Holocaust Museum without a copy being given to the National Archives, so that ordinary scholars in universities or outside could have access to that information. So Wiesel, he's been unable to prove that he was ever where he claims to have been, but it's difficult for us to disprove because the records are being held by the Holocaust Museum.
And just the creation of the Holocaust Museum, which occurred under Carter, and the only reason that Carter did this was because the Democrats were funding him, and the biggest funders in the Democrat Party were Jewish, and so in order for him to try to win his second election, he catered to their needs, as did Congress, and he did it for strictly political reasons and for no other reason except to and in creating the Holocaust Museum, a state-sponsored edifice on publicly owned ground, that established the Holocaustianity as the nation's state-sponsored religion. Correct?
Yeah. Well, Jimmy Carter was informed going into in the third year of his 4 years in office, that if he wanted to get the big Jewish donors to cough up money, he would have to give them something in return. And his chief of staff, or his under chief of staff, his head for Jewish affairs, was an attorney by the name of Stuart Eisenstadt. And Eisenstadt and other people on the staff lobbied for a Holocaust museum. And Carter finally caved in, knowing he had to do it if he wanted to get that money for his reelection bid. He also gave them public land, which belongs to the citizens of the United States. And he had no right to give that land to the most powerful and wealthiest ethnic group in the United States. If anybody deserved that land, it would have been American Indians or American blacks, who definitely, in both cases, underwent discrimination and suffering that has an American context, whereas the suffering that is associated with the Holocaust never took place on American shores and has nothing at all to do with American history. But Jimmy Carter needed the money, and so he essentially betrayed the American people when he did that.
Yikes.
I think that's why he had it.
From your book. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, let's go back to my book again. One of the themes, as you know, in my book, is that Jewish people have been suspicious of Elie Wiesel from day one. They've been very suspicious of him. They don't like his over-the-top delivery. They don't like all the rolling of the eyes and all the hyperbole and exaggeration. And many of them have said that silence would have been much better than to what he does. And that theme runs all through the book. It's not as if all Jewish people in the United States are on board with the Holocaust. Nothing could be further from the truth. Many of them are as fed up with the Holocaust story as non-Jewish people are, but there's not too much they can do about it. I quote Rabbi Jacob Neusner a number of times, Neusner, in the course of my book, from the beginning to the end. Jacob Neusner just retired recently from Bard College, B-A-R-D, up on the Hudson River, north of New York City. He might be the most widely published rabbinical writer, Jewish public intellectual, in the United States. And one of his major themes of his writing is that the Holocaust has been a great instrument for defending Israel in its war crimes against the Palestinians. It's a distraction. But it has not been successful in keeping young Jewish boys and girls in the fold. The intermarriage rate with non-Jews, especially among non-Orthodox Jews, has gone absolutely haywire. And he points out that the Holocaust story has not encouraged young Jews to move to Israel. And even worse, it has encouraged them into intermarriage. They're fleeing their Jewish identity, in part because of the Holocaust story. And I point out at the end of the book that the latest Pew survey, which was published in the New York Times in 2013, 71% of non-Orthodox Jewish boys and girls marry non-Jews. So the effect of the Holocaust story on these kids is just absolutely overwhelming, because the Holocaust story tells you you should hate your Gentile neighbor, because you never know when they're going to turn around and stab you in the back and do terrible things to you. And most Jewish boys and girls reject this as nonsense. And the way they show their feelings is they seek to escape from the fold. Whether their children will remain Jewish is their business, and nobody can predict what is going to happen. But there's been a tremendous loss. There's even an intermarriage rate among Orthodox Jews that's about 40% with non-Jewish people. But the unorthodox, the Jews who are Jewish in name only but do not practice, they are just escaping. So the Holocaust is not something that all Jewish folks are lined up in favor of. And I point out that going back to the very, very beginning, that many of them have been skeptical about it. And in Wiesel's early essays from the 60s, when he was first starting to publish in Commentary magazine and when his essays were being translated from French into English, one of the biggest complaints that he made is that American Jews were so skeptical about the tall stories that the Holocaust survivors were telling. Why do you keep asking these questions? Why do you tell us you don't believe this, you don't believe that? Why do you ask us about the Jewish councils? The Jewish councils were the groups that were set up all over Europe in order to recruit people to go and work in the camps and so forth. So that many of the people who, like in France, for instance, do you want to ask me a question?
No, I'm just reveling in your knowledge.
Well, just let's talk about France. That's a country I know pretty well. In France in World War II, there were about, let's see, there were over, I don't have the exact number in my head, it's about 140,000 to about 420 or 450,000 Jews living in France at the time. There are 280,000 Jews living in France at the time of the war. Most of them had come from Eastern Europe and didn't have passports, were not French citizens. Well, during the war, 70,000 of these 280,000 people were sent to camps, to work camps, Germany was a small country. It only had 60 million people, 40,000 Protestants and 40 million Protestants approximately, and 20 million Catholics. It was a small country up against Russia, the United States, Great Britain, huge populations. Also, Germany had a law which was more or less observed that women couldn't work in factories under Nazi ideology. Women had to stay home and be a hausfrau and take care of the house. That changed by 1945, but not much. So the Germans had a tremendous need for labor. They needed labor. And so they needed to draft people. In a country like France, they occupied France. They said to the French in control of the country, give us some Jewish laborers. We need people to run the factories in Buchenwald and Auschwitz. Auschwitz was a massive industrial complex. And at the time, the town of Auschwitz, which was founded by Germans in the year 1270, it had been a German city from 1270 until the Treaty of Versailles. There were huge camps all around where the laborers lived, a huge railroad network bringing them there. So the Jewish councils in Paris and all over France, they decided, let's take all the Jewish people. No French citizens were sent to work. No Jewish French citizens were sent to the camps. All the ones who went were either communists or people without a passport from Poland and places like that. And they're the ones who got sent off to the camps to labor. I don't use the word survivor. I use the word veteran. These people were drafted. They were in the German sphere of influence. They were drafted, and they were sent to work camps to labor on behalf of the German war effort. And the Germans believed that after the war was over, those people would be resettled in the east in Poland. There's no doubt that there was an ethnic cleansing program going on here, but what else is new? Ethnic cleansing programs have been going on from time immemorial. So that's how those people came to go there, and I call them veterans. Why? Because in 1944 and 1945, the United States was getting down toward the bottom of the barrel. For the most part, they were drafting kids as soon as they turned 18 years of age. The United States government drafted boys. Most of the boys who were drafted in 18, most of the boys who went in the infantry or in the Marine Corps, they were 18 years old. The average age of an infantryman was about 19 years old in 1945 when they were going into Germany toward the end of the war. These boys were drafted as veterans, and exactly they went. They weren't gung-ho. They didn't want to go. They were taken away from their homes. It's been estimated that 80% of the boys were drafted into the U.S. Army in 1944 and 1945 had never been outside the county in which they were born when they got drafted in, and they were sent over to Europe. And here they were campaigning through Germany. Every German town was a museum, and here they saw all these churches being blown up, villages being torn apart, American bombers and British bombers completely carpet bombing the population. And so I call the so-called survivors veterans in the same sense. They were recruited to go and work in work camps against their will, just as American boys were drafted into the Army in 1944 and 1945 and put in the infantry and put on the front lines. And many of them didn't even get any training. They were put in so-called replacement battalions that got drafted. They might have had a month or two and didn't get a full infantry school training. And they were put in so-called replacement battalions, and they were sent up to the front without any training whatsoever, scared out of their wits. So we have to put all these things into context. I might add another thing, that when in the 1960s, when the Holocaust story started to be made so important, that, I mean, our newspapers and TV stations are full of it day after day, 365 days a year. They would not have been able to pull this off in 1945 because there were a million casualties in the U.S. Armed Services. there are 600,000 dead from all causes and 400,000 wounded. And I recall in the middle to late 40s, men walking around with severed arms and legs on wheelchairs. Men who lost both legs used to get wheeled around on little dollies because there was a lack of wheelchairs. And so the Jewish so-called survivors of the camps, they didn't dare, they never would have been able to make claims about their own sufferings with so many American boys and men walking through up and down Main Street America with the result of the limbs they had lost and eyes poked out and so forth. It's interesting, isn't it?
It is. And in your book, you also state that the French Jews that were deported to the labor camps, they were deported by French Jews. So,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Yes, go ahead.
You theoretically, after the war, you could have a ship sailing from France coming into New York Harbor, and it had thousands of displaced persons on the boat. But on the boat, you would have not only some people who went to the camps, but the people who had sent them there as well, both coming into the States as displaced persons.
Yikes. And, I mean, it wasn't like they were compelled to go to the work camps. They agreed to go, and they took their families with them, correct?
You what?
There were children, women and children in the camp, in the labor
yes.
camps.
And well, the reason why they sent the women and children was because if they just sent the men, then all the local Jewish councils, the Jewish communities in France, I can speak specifically, the Jewish people in the Jewish communities, they were French first and foremost. They weren't people without passports. They weren't Polish refugees who could barely speak French. They said to the French government, if you arrest the father and send him to a work camp, we have no way of taking care of the mother and the kids. We don't have any way to take care of these people. So you take care of them. You send the whole kit and caboodle out there, and you take care of them. Well, that's the way they did it then. The Germans took everybody. And so what they had to do was organize a whole, the camps were huge villages with nurseries and hospitals of the whole nine yards to take care of people. And many of the people who went were unable to work. Wiesel claims that his father was never able to work. Not that I believe that his father was ever in a camp, but his father was a very sickly person. And if he ever did go to a camp, he was never able to work. There are many people like him.
And yet the Germans fed them. They fed them and took care of them. If it was an extermination camp, they would have done them in, right?
Exactly. If it had been an extermination camp, they would have knocked them off right away. But, of course, they didn't. When the war was over in 1945, there were 700 children in the so-called children's block at Auschwitz. Now, why were the Germans taking... there were 700 kids, and the records indicate that there's about 500 kids were born at Auschwitz, if not more. So, no, they just had to take care of all these people. They were getting them ready to ship them out after they won the war, but, of course, they didn't win the war.
Right. Okay. So continue. I don't want to interrupt you. I want you to talk.
I want to talk about Elie Wiesel's Nobel Prize campaign.
Oh, yes.
How they got to give him the Nobel Prize. It was important for him to get the Nobel Prize. And when he was campaigning to get the prize with the full backing of the New York Times, that he invented one of his biggest lies, which is that in the famous picture from the Buchenwald camp that was taken about April 18th, about a week or so after the camp was liberated by U.S. forces, there's the famous picture of the men in the bunks, they're all piled
exactly.
up in the bunks. And he
exactly.
claims to be the guy up in the top bunk in the back. Well,
right.
of course, it's completely ridiculous. He was a boy of 15, and this man is 35 years old. sitting there in the bunk. The U.S. Holocaust Museum still claims that Wiesel is there in that picture against all evidence. And it's ridiculous. Any Tom, Dick, or Harry can see it's not the same person. But he wanted to make that claim, knowing that nobody in the controlled media would ever contest something that the New York Times said. So he told the New York Times that he was in that picture. And then in the run-up to the awarding of the Nobel Prize, the New York Times said in an article, oh, we just found out Elie Wiesel has self-identified himself in this picture. And here he is. So they cropped the picture in such a way, and so you could barely see who the guy was. Many of the men in the bunks have got whiskers, beards, 5-day beards. They're men in their 30s and 40s. Well, Wiesel has always declared that this picture was taken in the children's block, in the children's part of the Buchenwald. It's just ridiculous, the things they tell you. Well, when he made that claim, and I might add that that picture is still in a prominent site on the site of the Holocaust Museum, That was all part of his build up to prove that he had been a victim and that he was really there. And as I said, no one in the media and certainly none of the conformists in academe would ever challenge that absurd claim, because that's just the way it is in our country, as you know. So then he finally got the Nobel Prize, and a funny thing happened after he got the Nobel Prize. Some reporters contacted Simon Wiesenthal, you know, the so-called Nazi hunter in Austria, and they asked him what he thought about Wiesel's prize, and he said, this is ridiculous. I thought we were supposed to split the prize. That's what everybody told me. Uh-huh. I was at half, and he was supposed to get half, and I finally got the news that he got the prize. I told the people in my staff and the secretaries in the office, they were all in tears. Everybody was so upset because he thought the fix was in. That's what they had told him, but the fix was in just for Wiesel.
Wow.
But see, that occurred in 1986, and the year before, in 1985, that's when President Reagan invited him to the White House, and when I claimed that he was made the Holocaust High Priest in a special ceremony when he was awarded a medal by Ronald Reagan, and the Holocaust was essentially made into our national religion. And putting Wiesel in place and making the Holocaust the national religion of the United States, it dovetails with the war against Christmas, the disappearance of Christmas trees and creches and baby Jesus and so forth from public spaces in American life. There's a replacement that has been put in its place.
State-sponsored, actually.
Yeah.
Yes.
Amazing. Well, I want to talk about Tove Reich. She's a novelist, Tove Reich, and she's the wife of Walter Reich, who for a short period of time in the 80s was the honcho at the Holocaust Museum. Tove Reich is a very talented novelist. He spells her name T-O-V-A and then R-E-I-C-H. She published a novel in about 2007 called My Holocaust. And in My Holocaust, she satirizes Elie Wiesel. She presents him through a fictional character who's the head of the Holocaust Museum. He has a son named Norman. And Norman is ashamed of his father because he's always telling these Holocaust stories, all this BS that nobody can possibly believe. And so somebody says to Norman one day, you know, don't you feel embarrassed that your father's going around telling all these phony stories about all of his heroics and all the horrors that he saw? And so Norman says, you know, that's the way it is. I wish it weren't like that. But, that's the way he is. Well, this novel was so scathing. The reviews that she received across the country from the largely Jewish media and intellectual establishment, they were just outrageous that she would have the nerve to make fun of Wiesel this way and to call him a liar the way she did. I concentrate on the review of the book that was published in the New York Times by a guy named Margolis, and that review was just It was just all daggers. He just cut Tova right to pieces, stating, among other things, these are the kinds of things that Jewish people usually only discuss among themselves. We don't discuss stuff like this with other people, much less write novels. Write novels that criticize one of our most sacred of sacred cows in public life in America. She was given the right to write a little rejoinder to that review. She only wrote about three or four paragraphs, pointing out that that was satire, and it's in satire when you make fun of something, you do wicked comedy. That's what the book was all about, and of course there's truth at the basis of satire. Well, it was very courageous of her to do that, and it was a terrific book.
Indeed. And there have been others that, well, there were a lot of Jewish people that that were embarrassed by him and didn't believe his story. But then all of a sudden, these same people that didn't believe his story, particularly the ones in New York, thought, well, okay, let's get behind him. And why did they change?
Oh, why did they change?
Yes.
I'm not sure I followed the whole question. Why did they change their point of view?
Yes.
You're going to have to ask me that again. They were all in favor of the Holocaust, and now they're not. Is that what you're saying?
Well, they weren't in favor of Elie Wiesel or Wiesel, and they didn't believe his nonsensical stories. But then all of a sudden, well, not all of a sudden, but incrementally, they decided to back him and to go along with him for the sake of Zionistic objectives in Israel. I mean, because there were a lot of people, a lot of Jews, who did not believe his story.
Yeah, but exactly, because within the Jewish community, it's very difficult. It's very difficult for those people to speak up because they get called the self-hating Jews and so forth. It makes your life absolutely impossible. And many will go along with Wiesel and not say anything because, of course, his name is associated with Israel. He never criticizes what's being done to the Palestinians and is completely in accord with all the extremists in the Likud party who run Israel. So it's much easier for such people to keep a low profile. But many of the younger ones are, of course, marrying outside the faith and moving on. I wanted to talk about after Wiesel won the Nobel Prize, and the nun, he hired a nun by the name of Carol Rittner to become the secretary or the executive secretary of his foundation once he created a foundation. So you say to yourself, why would he hire a nun to be in charge of the Elie Wiesel Foundation? And why would this woman who became a nun because she supposedly had a religious vocation to devote her life to seeking Christ and do Christ-like things, why would she want to get involved in working for a group that pushes the Holocaust story and justifies Israel and occupation of Palestine and all the rest of it? And my answer would be that there are very, very tangible rewards. It didn't take long for the sister Carol Rittner, after she had worked for Wiesel, to be given a chaired position at a college, a university in New Jersey, to get a big salary. And she's the head of the Department of Genocide, became the full professor in the Department of Genocide Studies.
Wow.
I point out how there are so many Catholics who have gone along with the Holocaust story in order to advance their own career. And Sister Carol Rittner is another one of them who has done that.
Wiesel himself got this plush position at in a college and in two colleges. And yet, he really was not formally educated. He never attended. He didn't have a doctorate. He was not educated. And then all of a sudden, he's a full-fledged professor. Awesome.
That's amazing. That's truly amazing. He never finished high school, and He came to the United States, and he was hired as a part-time faculty member at City College in New York City. And then all of a sudden, he was not only given a tenure-track position, he was also, as you say, he was made a full professor, made a university professor, a distinguished professor. And then after he was there at City College, then the powers that be gave him a position in a private university. I think they moved him, the powers that be moved him from a public to a private because they could pay him much more money there. Public universities tend to have, like the federal government, you know, rates of pay that go in accordance with time and rank and seniority and so forth. But once he went to Boston University, a private university in Boston, then they could pay him anything they wanted. And, of course, he brought in tons of money from donors. And now there's actually a center, a so-called Center for Holocaust Studies or some such thing at Boston University that's named after him. And how ironic that it should have his name after I've shown in my book that it's 99% sure that he was never in any camp during the war. We don't know anything about what he did during the war years. And yet there at that private university, there's a Center for Holocaust Studies named after someone who's a demonstrable charlatan.
Exactly.
That's amazing.
Are you there? It's also amazing that the story you told about
the question
same
of homosexuality.
Okay, yeah, talk about that.
The question of homosexuality comes up in the book, and it comes up in a number of different ways. I show at the beginning of the book that François Mauriac, the distinguished French novelist, who was the first European intellectual to accuse Pius XII of so-called silence, quote-unquote, during the war years, that he was a father of four and ostensibly a Catholic writer. But he had this private life of being interested in young men and carrying on homosexual affairs. And so there's this nagging question as to why did Drezel pick out François Mauriac as somebody to help him start his career? I'm not saying that they had a sexual affair, but why of all the different writers who were in vogue in the 1950s and who either belonged to the French Academy, or why did he pick out Mauriac, who in politics was pretty much in the center? He wasn't either radical right or radical left. There are so many left-wingers who were pro-communist and pro-Israel that he could have gone to, Bezel could have gone to help him start his career. Why did he pick out Mauriac? And in fact, was it related to Mauriac's widely known penchant for liking young men? Oh, that's interesting. I mentioned that. And then, of course, there's the scene in the cattle car. At least in the novel, he talks about his family traveling. It's a 3-day, 4-day trip from where they live in Hungary, Romania, to the camp in Silesia, at the Auschwitz camp. And the first night, he talks about all the Jewish boys, the Orthodox Jewish boys, committing sodomy on each other, while all the other men and children and women just sit there and do nothing. Well, this is just an incredible scene. I've always been shocked by it. And in 2007, rabbis in France just couldn't take it anymore. And they petitioned the publishing house that has the rights to Wiesel's novel in French. And they asked them to change the verb from they were committing sexual relations with each other to they were just petting each other. Changed the verb in French, which they did, and so as to avoid the scandal of having them actually sodomizing each other. Now they're just, I suppose, making out on the train,
or embracing
still,
or something.
It's still pretty shocking.
Right. Now, one of the big things, too, in your book, as you point out, is that he claims that when he got to the camp, that he saw these great big pits, and they had thrown in a truckload of babies, and that they were burning them alive, and you could see all the smoke. And you point out that if the Jews had actually witnessed all of these things that he claims to have been seeing, they would not have passively waited their turn in line to march into the well, what later became the gas ovens. He never Wiesel never mentioned gas ovens or death by gassing. His was always the burning pits with all the smoke and nonsense. So could you tell us about the transition from the burning of these children and people to the gas ovens and how that affected his whole narrative?
Well, you're right. From the very, very beginning of the story in 1945, when it was first presented through the American media and European media to the people, the whole story was supposedly secret, that everything was done in absolute secrecy so that they never found out until the very last minute what was going to happen. So the story was they were completely fooled. Remember, Wiesel's book, one of the big problems with Wiesel's book is that of all the so-called eyewitnesses, he doesn't make any claims about gas chambers. He claims that when he first got into the camp, he was put in a line, and he was marched in a group of 50 or so people right up to this huge flaming pit. That's where the word Holocaust comes from, flaming pit, and that there was one big pit where dump trucks were dumping adults, and then there's another big pit where dump trucks were dumping babies. Well, if such pits existed and they were burning at 10 or 15,000 degrees centigrade in heat and giving off smoke that could be seen for miles around, this contradicts, as you say, the whole secrecy part of the story, which was built into the story at the Nuremberg trials. And all the original historians, quote unquote, of the Holocaust in the 40s and 50s and 60s always said everything was total and absolute secrecy, so that people sat around standing in line never knowing what was going to happen. Of course, this was the tip off, this whole thing about secrecy, which indicated to many Native Americans, many Jewish Americans, they couldn't imagine fellow Jews standing in line for a day or so without making a holler and a fuss and complaining and wanting to know what was going on. So they immediately, many of them knew that the story was a scam. So yes, Faisal's story with claiming that there were these used pits and flames were seen for miles around contradicts the basic legend of the Holocaust story. And that today is something that haunts the story, in that they claim that most people were killed in these so-called gas chambers. But then, why do you call that a Holocaust? Because a Holocaust was a term that was coined with reference to flaming pits.
Right. And then what about the aerial photographs that were released?
Yeah, that was a fantastic thing that happened in 1979, and when nobody can really be sure about why the two former CIA intelligence analysts released these pictures. But what happened is this: in 1979, these two men published a book. The CIA published it for them. It was a brochure about 30 pages in length, in which they revealed and confirmed for the first time that there had been aerial photographs taken over the Auschwitz camp between April and, I think, August or September of 1944. People had suspected this until 1979. That's between 1945 and 1979. Such pictures were rumored to have existed, but they were never actually published. And once they were published, that was the end of the Holocaust story. Now, because they were unable to show in these pictures any long lines of 10,000 people waiting to go into a gas chamber, unable to show any trace of Wiesel's flaming pits or trenches or anything else burning, no smoke, no huge conflagrations, no huge assemblages of people and so forth. There's actually nothing going on. It's like a little village with nothing going on. But it's one thing to have the evidence published for all to see. It's another thing to see what will happen to that evidence when it passes through the filter of the mainstream media. So within a week or two of the publication of that booklet, as I point out in my book in great detail, the New York Times and the Washington Post published a review of the book in which they said, oh, yeah, they don't go so far as to say what I say it should have shown. That's to say, it should have shown the flaming trenches, it should have shown things that were unbelievable, it should have shown lines of up to 10,000 people. It says, well, in one place you can see there seems to be a small line of people going to the gas chamber. And in another place behind a house there seems to be a little fire. You know, somebody might have been burning garbage or something like that. But they enabled the whole thing to go through as if there was nothing whatsoever to be concerned about, as if these pictures completely confirmed the Holocaust story as the way it's given to the people in the mainstream media. But of course, that's not the truth. As a result of the publication of those pictures in 1979, the two sides know who's right and who's wrong. And the people who support the especially academics should really be ashamed of themselves, because since 1979, hundreds if not thousands of these pictures have been published, and they all side with the revisionist version of events, and none of the pictures side with the official version of events as found in the mainstream media, TV, and so forth. But in academia, if you try to tell the truth, you risk losing your job in short order. So those folks are under the same pressure as people who work in the media.
Wow. And the function of the Holocaust Memorial Museum, it is just amazing that it was created to begin with. But what is its current function? And who are the vulnerable people who are now being brainwashed into believing this nonsense?
Well, this is a real concern for me, because brainwashing, first of all, takes place in schools, and the kids have to read the book. And you can imagine if any youngster in high school reads the book and the kids in the classroom discuss it, if any of the children say to the teacher any of the things that I have just said to you today, can you imagine what's going to be done to a kid who dares to raise any questions like that? Or if a child goes home and hears a dad or mom say, oh, this book seems like it's a bunch of baloney to me. A kid who said that to the teacher would be marched out of the principal's office in no time. Or, if not that, be sure to get a C or a D in the class. So the kids learn in school. They learn in school. They learn at school the way they're supposed to approach this text. They're not supposed to ask any questions whatsoever. And there's a program that the Anti-Defamation League has, and it's a program called Bearing Witness. And in this program, they hold out free trips to Israel to high school teachers. So they'll take teachers from public schools, religious-related schools of various kinds, and they send them as a reward. If they write a good essay in an essay contest, they get a 1 week trip to Israel, something like that, for further brainwashing. So there are a lot of people who are like the the hamsters on the wheel, who are being trained to go and ring the bell. So the teachers are trained to believe everything that's in the book. There's only one interpretation. And when you start to read Elie Wiesel's book, forget your natural skepticism about anything. You just have to follow the line. So they indoctrinate the kids. Then they take the kids on the trip. They go on the trip. They go down there. And according to the museum, it's the third most popular site to visit when the people get there. I don't know what the first two are, but maybe the Smithsonian might be one, but it's the third most visited site. Then when the kids get there, they take, or they used to anyway, they take the elevator up to the main floor, and they come out, and there's a big picture on the wall facing them. It's a picture of a pile of dead bodies being incinerated. It's a pile of dead bodies being incinerated on a flaming pyre, P-Y-R-E. Now, where does this picture come from? This is a picture from one of the sub-camps of Buchenwald. It was the first sub-camp that GIs stumbled upon in April 1945. And this sub-camp, like Buchenwald itself, ran out of medicine and water about 3-4 weeks before the U.S. soldiers got there. Because of American and British carpet bombing, the camps no longer had any medicine, nor did they have running water. So they were unable to take care of the people who were in the camp. They didn't do this deliberately. This was an American war crime. This was a British war crime committed through carpet bombing. You'll never hear that in an American classroom anywhere at any level. So the Germans who were in charge of the camp, in order to get, there was a raging typhus epidemic that began in December of 1944, and it touched the whole Buchenwald area. And in order to get rid of these dead bodies, they improvised, they took logs and built this pyre to burn all the germs that were in these dead bodies as a sanitation measure. But when these poor high school kids see this gruesome picture, they come out. Sure, the picture was taken by an American soldier, but it's not a picture of people being burned alive. It's anything but. It's a picture of dead bodies, bodies of people whose deaths had been occasioned by American carpet bombing of the area. They also bombed out the power plant in the neighboring town, so there was no electricity in addition, and that's why there was no water, there was no electricity, there was no medicine. So these gruesome pictures are presented to these kids. It's absolutely horrible. One of my concerns, in addition to the brainwashing it is administered to American youth in the classroom in conjunction with the Holocaust story, is what goes on in Catholic schools, because here the Catholic side has abandoned any pretense of objectivity. When they engage in so-called exchanges with the rabbis on the Jewish side, it doesn't mean that Catholic kids go over to the Jewish day school and talk about why they believe in Christ and how he fulfilled the promises in the Old Testament. Forget it. Rabbis and so-called self-identified survivors, they go over to the Catholic school, they go in a religion class, and they start talking about all these atrocities that they supposedly saw. They might bring along a PowerPoint show, good measure, I don't know what not, in order to brainwash and to send these Catholic kids off on a guilt trip. To me, it's absolutely disgusting. It's disgusting.
Right.
And of course,
go ahead.
They get shipped off to Washington, and when they get to Washington, that's the cherry on the cake of their indoctrination. That's the icing on the cake.
A religious pilgrimage. When they go to Auschwitz, it's a religious pilgrimage, and that's what the guides make it seem like. Well, I mean, it's just incredible. It's just incredible the way that you've put this whole thing together. I have
well, now
there
are
so much. Go ahead.
Pilgrimage. To take place now, there are pilgrimages from kids all over Europe are shipped out from various countries. They go to Auschwitz to make the tour. And you see on the internet that these various groups, Belgium, France, Germany, they try to avoid the spring around April, about the time of so-called Holocaust Remembrance Day, when there are thousands of kids from Israel who go there, and they engage in what they call the March of the Living. They march from the main camp in the town of Auschwitz. There's a small barracks. It's called Auschwitz One, and they walk out to the main complex where the bigger camp was located. It's about a 2-kilometer walk, depending upon how fast you walk. You can do it in a half an hour, up to an hour or so, depending upon your speed. And people say it's horrible to go to take. It's bad enough these poor kids are brainwashed, but when they go there, and the Israelis are also there, it's really horrible because they're so poorly behaved, because they feel that they have a right to insult the Poles, to behave badly in the hotels, to conduct themselves in an abominable way. And so the word is out. When you're brainwashing your kids in a school in France or Sweden or Germany or Poland or Norway, whatever, you try to make your pilgrimage, quote-unquote, at a time when the Israelis won't be there in large numbers because they mess up the experience for other people because of their behavior and the right they feel that they have a right to make a nuisance of themselves.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I can understand that. Yeah, they think they are victimized, so they get to do whatever they want to anybody they want to, which is why they're...
I ask you to mention the name of my book again to your listeners.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The name of the book is Holocaust High Priest, Elie Wiesel, Night, the Memory Cult, and the Rise of Revisionism. People, please, if you never buy another book this week, or I was going to say as long as you live, buy this book. It's a must-have book, and buy an extra copy. Buy as many copies as you can and share them with your brainwashed friends. The other thing, too, you brought up the, we were talking about the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and the implementation of the national state-sponsored religion that has replaced Catholicism, which the Jews felt was their last target. They had to get rid of Catholicism in order to make Holocaustianity the state religion. But the other way that they did this was to have, well, holidays, such as Holocaust.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. Tell us about that.
That's right. They've taken a number of the features of Catholicism and just taken them over into the new religion. So you have your Holocaust Remembrance Day in April, and then you have the Liberation of Auschwitz Day in January. Then you have your survivors. They're like the apostles. They're like the apostles. Wiesel, of course, is the Holocaust high priest. He presents himself as a Christ figure. And he rose from the dead, just that Catholics or all Christians believe that Christ rose from the dead. Of course, in the Holocaust story, it's supposedly the Jewish people who were supposedly the victims of an extermination attempt. They rise from the dead. They also have pilgrimage sites. They have the pilgrimage site at Auschwitz and so forth. Another thing I mentioned in my book is my conviction that the Holocaust is a form of lowbrow culture.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that in particular in a part of the book. Let me see if I can go to that part of the book where I talk about these movies that came out in the early part of the 20th century, like like Inglourious Basterds and The Reader, movies like that. And in The Reader, there's a lot of nudity that goes on in there. In Inglourious Basterds, there's a lot of killing and violence. And what it comes down to is that people, ordinary people, won't go to a Holocaust movie unless there's going to be violence or nudity or a sexual attraction to it, because more and more adults are just turned off by the misuse of violence in the ordinary media. And so it's not a good thing for it to be such a lowbrow form of art. Here, I have that section of the book here right in front of me. The pianist in 2002 got all these awards and so forth, and it features scenes in which men just walk around in the all together without any clothes on for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And then you have Inglourious Basterds, and then there's the one in which that British actress, the Reader, a well-known British Kate Winslet, appeared in the news for 15 in the movie for 15 or 20 minutes without any underwear on. It's a means to attract people to these movies, and it's an unfortunate thing that if you're trying to promote the Holocaust and make people feel sorry for these atrocities, that you have to use low-class forms of entertainment to do it.
Right. Yeah, I remember I was going to watch The Pianist, and I started watching, and I thought, this is garbage. I just didn't even watch the rest of it. I mean, it's just, people don't, well, it is, like you say, the Holocaust narrative is a form of lowbrow culture. But so many people believe it. So many people believe that this occurred. And of course, it's because it's so much a part of the entertainment media. There were so many films that were directed and produced right after World War II that people saw. I mean, there were hundreds, and they were considered documentaries.
Yeah, it's just repeated day after day after day. You can't escape it. Kids grow up. If you look at your average mainstream newspaper, it's obsessed with just a couple subjects: World War II and the Holocaust. World War II, of course, being the good war. I happen to believe it was a bad war. It might be one of the worst things that ever happened to American society. So, but the glorification of World War II, the Holocaust. Then, of course, there's the civil rights movement. We hear about that 24/7. I feel sorry for all the black folks who were discriminated against prior to that. And it's not as if the civil rights movement all of a sudden yielded a much better standard of living for black folks in the United States. In fact, if Martin Luther King could come back today, he would see how low down and how desperate most black people actually are today in comparison to where they were in the age of segregation. At that time, being officially discriminated against, they stuck together through thick and thin, policed their own communities, and made amazing strides in the face of terrific odds. Now black folks are completely spoiled by the politicians, and they're so dependent upon welfare and other forms of public assistance. The family is completely gone, and it's just tragic. It's heartbreaking. I'm glad Martin Luther King doesn't have to see what his work has resulted in.
Exactly. Now, you don't mention Corrie Ten Boom in your book at all, but I note that they use a lot of children, or at least that they create these stories, like the Corrie Ten Boom story and the Anne Frank story and things like that, that appeal to well, to kids, to a younger generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And
how talking
do you,
about?
Well, like the Diary of Anne Frank and all of the other books that have come out, which you mention. You say in your book that the revisionist, in order for people to not look at the revisionist, that the Jews really don't say a whole lot. They just produce more books, so they kind of just ignore the revisionist, and that the whole reason for the establishment of the Holocaust Memorial Museum was to discredit or to minimize the work of the revisionist so that more people would ignore the revisionist and pay attention to the Holocaust and embrace the Holocaust narrative.
Well, you're right. As long as we have the internet, as long as the internet is free, then revisionist work will continue to go around the world instantaneously, and that will be very bad for Holocaust business. However, in the United States, there are people who are working tirelessly to bring the internet, which we're using, which we were trying to use earlier,
right,
on Skype, people trying to bring the internet under control, because on the Holocaustian side, they know that they can't win the argument based on facts because the facts are not on their side. The facts are on the side of the revisionists, and they should really begin to make some serious concessions to the revisionists. But they do nonetheless control the media. They own the media and control the media. And so what they're trying to do is expand that control and not only ban revisionist discourse from the internet. They also want to make it a crime, a violation of penal law, not just civil law, so that anybody who voices any doubt in the Holocaust story will be put in jail for 10 or 15 years and fined $10,000, whatever it might be. So that's their main focus right now, is getting the internet under control, and they work very quietly behind the scenes until at the last minute. I pray to God it doesn't happen. Then they would pounce on us and surprise us at the last minute. But they know, in terms of facts and just open debate, free and open debate, it's a debate that they can never win. Just, the facts just aren't on their side.
And in fact, they don't debate it. Well, there's been a few people who have debated it, but they, as you say, the facts just don't stand. Let's see. What else did you want to cover? There's so many things in your book to cover. Oh, my gosh. Okay, the changing of the 4 million sign at Auschwitz. You talk about, you have an image in your book that was put there by the Soviets. 4 million people suffered and died here at the hands of the Nazi murderers between the years 1940 and 1945. And, of course, in 1991, they just removed 2.5 million people.
Yeah, I treat these changes in the context of the expression retroactive continuity. Retroactive continuity is something that's used in the American TV and radio industry. For instance, if you have a series, or let's say a soap opera, and it goes on for 20 years, at some point, for whatever reason, you want to eliminate a character from the soap opera, it's entirely able to do because it might cause confusion with a new character. So in soap operas and series of any kind, and in series like Superman, whatever it might be, it's rather common to delete a theme or delete a fact from a character from a previous episode, as if that character had never existed before. So a particular person in a soap opera who's a mother who used to have two kids has only got one kid because that child was deleted for reasons internal to the script writers. Well, the same thing happens in the Holocaust story, in that there, the Auschwitz sign with the 4 million dead, that just was taken down, and it's as if that claim had never existed before. At Nuremberg, Tom Dodd, the father of Senator Dodd from Connecticut, he was in charge of, he was one of the chief assistants to the American prosecutor. And one of the people on the staff was a Jewish doctor who had lived in Brazil during the war years. And while he was in Brazil, he collected a whole bunch of shrunken heads that some tribe, often the Boonies in Brazil, had made. Well, he put these shrunken heads in a suitcase and carried them around with him. He eventually wound up on the prosecution staff in Nuremberg in 1945. And when Senator Dodd's father, I believe his name was Tom Dodd, he was a lawyer from Connecticut, when he opened up the proceedings, he put out two or three of these shrunken heads on the table for U.S. journalists to see. They were dramatically... there was a veil over them, a sheet over them. He picked up the sheet, unveiled these shrunken heads, and a couple of the shrunken heads, little teeny-weeny things about the size of a baseball that these people in this primitive tribe in Brazil had done and that this Jewish doctor had brought. Well, Tom Dodd said that this is what the Nazis had done to Jewish prisoners in the camp, the shrunken heads. And at the same time, they accused the Germans making lampshades out of human skin, out of making soap out of human fat. Of course, these are all tall tales that were made up in the overactive imagination of so-called eyewitnesses. All that, we had to bear with that from the 1940s until the revisionists started to really get going in the 60s and 70s. But now the shrunken heads, the lampshades, the made out of skin, and so forth. These stories have been completely suppressed through the use of retroactive continuity, as if these ridiculous claims had never been made in the first place. And yet, people repeatedly use those claims for 30 years as the main proof that the Germans were barbarians. Now they're completely forgotten.
That's amazing.
It is amazing that they get away with it and nobody in the media ever notices it.
Right.
Totally amazing.
And people have discredited these and discredited them, and it just doesn't matter. People still talk about these things as if they were real. But the Jews themselves don't bring this up too much anymore.
Of course.
Or
No, they don't believe it. I think one of the big things that has to happen these days is we need to really stop all the Holocaust to brainwashing that's going on in schools. But it's very, very difficult because it's related to so many other things. This is what the Holocaust brainwashing in schools is related to. Now we must have, I don't know if there are 20 or 30 Holocaust museums all around the country. I've lost track. They're all over the place. And every one of these museums has got its own little bookstore or gift shop. And so in that gift shop, we're going to have more and more people who are being encouraged to write down their supposed memoirs about tragedies or atrocities that they saw. And so we'll continue to get these ridiculous books that come along because somebody will buy them in the bookstore. Then some of these books wind their way into classrooms for these poor kids to be forced to read, although Wiesel's book is pretty much the top one. And so there's a monetary incentive. The publisher of Wiesel's book, their name is Philip Strauss and Giroux, they must sell close to 1 million copies of the book every year. There's a huge incentive to keep on publishing that book. And in 2007, a new translation of the book was produced by Wiesel's wife, Marion.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason why the new English translation was produced at that time was because, as I say in the book, I really don't think that Wiesel wrote the book. I think that the novel is a book he found originally in Yiddish, written by somebody else, and he, or maybe an amalgam of several books or short stories, texts of various kinds that he found somewhere else that he took over for himself and that he published in Yiddish himself in a collection in Buenos Aires in 1955. In any case, the book was so poorly put together that it's just ridiculous. For instance, the opening scene in the novel says it was Passover Day, referring to the Jewish Passover. Well, in 1944, the Passover took place in the first week in May. But he was so stupid, he didn't even bother to check what date the Passover was. The Jewish Passover is like the Catholic Passover. It's a movable feast. It changes its date every year. It follows a lunar calendar. So here he opens his novel, and he says, the novel began on whatever. And then he finally finishes it. But if you look up on the calendar, you'll see that the feast of Passover was about May 2nd, 3rd, or 4th, whatever it might be. Then 4 days later, he gets to Auschwitz, and it was a beautiful day in April. So if you've gone to the calendar to see what day Passover was on in 1944, and you figure, well, he left home in May, how can he get there on a beautiful sunny day in April? Well, Wiesel never did any bothering to check, and that book was read by millions and millions of kids in brainwashing classes in America before Marion Wiesel rewrote the book, and they were forced to relieve all this nonsense. Well, when she rewrote it, she turned that phrase that says when he got there from a beautiful day in April to a beautiful day in May. Now, he never wrote a beautiful day in May. He wrote a beautiful day in April. So if a prestigious press for R. Strauss and Giroux, they should have at least had a footnote down to the bottom of the page saying, in the original text of Night in French and in all prior editions of this book, Elie Wiesel always wrote it was a beautiful day in April, but we're changing it to say it was a beautiful day in May because this guy is a loser.
Right.
It's absolutely mind-boggling. And the same thing happens in the second part of the book after he leaves the Buchenwald camp and he takes a trip to Buchenwald. The camp was liberated on January 17th, day of January 17th. And he describes a long trip that took several weeks. And yet he describes his father dying on January 28th, January 29th. Well, he doesn't give the departure date. He didn't know when he wrote the book, when he stole the book, he didn't know that the Germans and the Jewish refugees left the camp on January 16th. He didn't know that. But when you actually follow calendar-wise all the descriptions, then logically they would not have arrived in Buchenwald until something like February 22nd. But the only date that's given in the second half of the novel is the date at which his father died. But how could his dad have died on January 28th or 9th if they didn't get there until February 22nd? So yeah, here again, yeah. Marion Wiesel has to write. Mm-hmm. In one part where Wiesel writes, we traveled 10 days and 10 nights, she has to write something like, we traveled another night, in order for Wiesel to get there before January 28th or 29th. Again, the publisher has relinquished his duty and obligation to his reader, who has paid for this book, to say that he has changed the text of the book and that the original author with actually lying and making updates. So I try to get into these really, really delicate issues. That there, this cooperation here, this a major publishing house like Forrest, Strauss, and Review has dropped all of its obligations to its readers to tell the truth in order to be of service to Imperial America and its agenda, all the wars in the Middle East on behalf of Israel and so forth, which, of course, the Holocaust story is the justification for.
Right.
Dina, well, I'm starting to get hoarse. And I'm running out of gas.
Okay, we're just about at the end of the program, so it's a good time to run out of gas. But you also talk about the destruction of the European Jews by Hilberg, which was published by the Yale University Press and promoted. And this was as recently as 2003, and yet it's packed full of lies. So legitimate, or what we would consider legitimate publishing houses, are publishing this stuff. And you mentioned just a few minutes ago about all these people who are encouraged to talk about their Holocaust story. And, I mean, they're lying. These people are liars. Why do they do it? Do they do it because there's money in it or because it just keeps the narrative going?
It's very much like under the Soviet Union, where the state sets a party line and you follow the party line. And the powerful university presses and independent publishing houses like Forrest, Strauss, and Review, they know, in the case of a university press, federal grants for chemistry, physics, biology, whatever it might be, for all kinds of programs, for the medical school, federal grants are dependent upon towing the line that is set down in Washington. And the Holocaust story is the religion of America. So everybody has to get online, get in line, I should say, and support the state ideology. There's no place for anybody to raise any questions about it. It's sad. We live today. I weep when I think of what our country has become.
Indeed. Oh, my goodness. My goodness. My goodness. This book is just amazing. It is just absolutely incredible, and people thought, well, how could these people lie? And you've just explained it so that we can understand it, that it is the state-sponsored tale. It is the state-sponsored narrative that the majority of the people follow, including publishing houses, and of course that is why, why your book is published by somebody that actually publishes the truth, and thank goodness for that. And tell us who published your book.
Yeah, we have to be thankful that there still are some independent publishers who will publish the truth.
Exactly. And your book was published by Castle Hill Publishers.
Holocaust High Priest.
Yes.
Holocaust High Priest, Warren B. Routledge.
Right. And with a foreword by Germar Rudolph, who has spent time in prison for telling the truth. He was the chemist that did some excavation and some tests at Auschwitz, and tried to present his findings in a court. Anyway, I just am so grateful for your work, your courage, your book. It's outstanding. I hope that it sells a million copies. I really, really do. And I thank you for being on the program today. It has been delightful to have you on the program. And I wish you the best. I hope we can talk again.
Thank you.
And
bye, Dina.
Sorry for all of the technical difficulties at the beginning, but have a wonderful day. Thank you very much. Okay. Listeners, please do buy the book. You will not be disappointed. Absolutely not disappointed. Thank you.
It starts with you and me.
It starts with you.
It starts with you and me.